So good afternoon, it's a Friday afternoon and welcome to Read Me Something You Love with Saskia Vogel. Have I pronounced your name correctly?
Absolutely.
That's good. I thought it might have been Vogel or something like that. Yeah. Or
Saskia, Sasha, Saskia, that's me, every single name.
And Saskia is a writer and also a publicist here at Granta. But I don't really know you as a publicist. I know you mainly from your blog writings, essentially. You do some really, really interesting blog posts. I mean, how would you describe some of your more recent writings? I was trying to think of a way of describing it, and I couldn't really come up with the right term.
It reflects a bit of my activism around gender and sexuality, but also it's a place where I can kind of put seeds of thought, things that I'm thinking about, I don't know, sex and the body, or what certain things mean in culture. And I've also started interviewing women that I think are amazing, like Sonia Barnett, who was one of the co-founders of the Slut Walk movement. And gosh, just artist friends and things. So I guess it's reflective of the things that I really love and I'm interested in exploring.
And I think that does come across. It's not just filled on a need to fill basis.
I guess so. I mean, I've always been really interested in sex and culture. I guess you wake up and you see the world in a certain way, or you're born and your lens is colored that certain color. And I guess actually I was reading a Camille Paglia essay recently, and she said, "I am a pornographer. Ever since earliest childhood, I've suffused the world with sex, or seen the world suffused with sex." And somehow that made a lot of sense to me, the kind of awareness of power dynamics between people and how those are mobilized, I guess, in terms of social interactions in general. But when they're formalized in an erotic context, I think it opens up in a really interesting arena to kind of explore, you know, how we relate to each other and where, you know, where the erotic takes over the sort of very formal interactions we have as humans normally, you know.
Mm, which brings us, of course, very neatly to Netsuke. Not a writer I know, not a novel I know, but as soon as I started reading it, I was very excited because it does seem to come out, as I say, of the writing that you do online.
Gosh, that's a huge compliment. I think I've become something of a Ricky Ducournay super fan. The book was recommended to me last year, and I haven't been able to stop thinking or talking about it.
I'm very interested in seeing what we're going to sort of pull out of this today. So, please, whenever you're ready.
Although it is still very early, the wealth of the day is upon him. He is running. He is listening to Monteverde, and he is running. He is very muscled and lean. He lopes along hungry as a wolf. There's something regal about the canopy of leaves above him. The sun has only just lifted over the rim of the world. His days are made up of what he calls real time and the interstices. Real time provides an identity, a footing. The interstices, however, provide him with a life. The sun begins to spill onto the path. He runs dappled with light, hooked to Monteverde. He doesn't hear the birds rioting in the trees. He runs like a creature of the woods before the world truly began. Long before the first great cities of the world had ever been conceived, he is aware of his sex when he runs. There is a pretty woman, surely half his age, running toward him. As they are about to pass one another, his eyes leap into hers. She slows down and, turning, runs backward, looking at him. When he glances over his shoulder, she bursts into laughter. A gentle breeze lifts. The day shimmers with the music of Monteverde. Still laughing, she turns away and runs into the trees. It is like a movie, maybe an animated cartoon, he playing the centaur to her nymph. Yes, that's it. A centaur. In an instant, the world compresses into one point of heat and light. Off the path now, deep in the trees, they begin to devour one another's tongue and teeth, panting each time they surface for air. He pushes her up against a tree and takes her. She burns at the center of his life. He will never weary of fucking her. She rides him, he rides her, she drowns, he swims into her depths. She cries out, she trembles, she says wow, and laughs again, but very quietly. He emerges from her, and with a graceful, almost imperceptible gesture, rearranges his cock. He hesitates a moment. He tenderly brushes her cheek with the back of his hand and says, "Sorry, sweetheart, I've got to go to work." "Yeah." She nods and beams down at him as he fumbles with the lace of his sneaker. She sighs. She too pulls herself together. "So, what's work?" she asks lightly, not wanting to appear overly curious. "Needful." "Psychoanalysis," he says, eager now to get on his way. He thinks she looks like a kid, her straw-colored hair barely holding in a rubber band. A sweet-looking kid. A daisy among many of the field. "Bye, sweetheart," he says. And off he goes, turning once again to smile at her and wave. The gesture charming, attentive, and yet... "Hey!" she calls out after him. He is vanishing down the path. "Hey!" Theirs is a big city. Back home he showers and works up a lather. He's Neptune in a sea of foam. He is a god leaping from the interstices back to the real world. He recalls that for the gods, the real world was, in fact, the interstices. A playground, a mirror of the heavens, a theater. Each morning after his run is like this. He in a lather, reflecting, pummeled by water. He will stay in the shower for an hour, making himself over, making himself new. The process, he thinks, is alchemical. Today he is feeling especially philosophical. He considers the nature of women, the daisies of the field so fuckable, so breakable, the ones who call out, "Hey!" and stamp their feet in irritation like mares, the ones who blossom early only to succumb to nerves, those who startle easily and sour in an instant. Love with them is like sucking lemons. The lazy, careless women in need of pedicures who, when darkness falls, can be seen lolling about unkempt in tapas bars. The aging actresses, their sweet vulnerabilities on parade. Incandescent alcoholics as troublesome as fever dreams. Fantastic in the early hours of the evening, but only then. The chameleons, the gorgeous exotics prone to outbursts of temper. The luscious North Africans, their balaclava pussies. The antelope who cannot settle down, a good fuck on an airplane, taxicab, the train. The new mistress one fucks before sitting down to dinner with one's wife. The women who give courage, these are rare. The wild ones with magenta manes who wear boots in all seasons. The whore who brought down Enkidu, who showed him the things a woman knows how to do. The tribal types who like sex in clusters. The women who, at Christmas, consider suicide. The frisky ones, the ones who talk too much, the ones who kill with silence, the risk-takers, the ones with big ideas, the death cunts who kill with a look, the tender ones, the fayaways, like islands who love in cautious isolation, who rub one's feet. They have juicers. One abandons them judiciously, all the while cooing like a dove. The clients whom one fucks in the name of a unique experiment. The wives whom one betrays extravagantly. The current wife, Akiko. The one for whom the interstices were superseded, if only briefly, by the real. Akiko, whose beauty no longer troubles his sleep. His world is mazed with cunts, and he has not yearned for hers in centuries. An old prince of darkness. This is what he has become. His teeth worn to the gums. His tongue swollen with overuse. His cock, like his heart, close to breaking.
Thank you. It's interesting, this... We should have mentioned, perhaps, that this is essentially, I mean, it's written in italics, this first section. It's sort of like a prelude to the first chapter, an introduction. It's interesting that it finishes with his tongue swollen with overuse, his cock like his heart close to breaking, because my sense of this man particularly in the last section, is that this is, I don't get the feeling of a man whose heart is close to breaking. I get a sort of quite a distanced sense of him, and of him having quite a distant sense of him to himself.
Mm. Yeah, he's, I think you're absolutely right. You don't really get to know a man who you feel has contact with his great emotional depth. You know, you get these senses that he's kind of wafting above any real emotion, and you have some insight at some points, but yes, you don't really... He's caught close to breaking, I suppose. Yes, that makes sense. But his heart, no. The sort of old saying, or, you know, that men think with their genitals and not with their brain. You know, there's kind of an interesting undercurrent of kind of playfulness and humor in the way she presents him in the beginning. You know, because it's so overblown as well. I mean, he's a centaur. How sexy is that? You know.
And yet, I mean, it's interesting you use the word waft, because I do feel like we are sort of wafted into his world, and I'm not really sure. I'm not sure what dimension he's in here. I mean, is this a fantasy? I would imagine that there are very few heterosexual couplings that occur between middle-aged men jogging in the morning through woods.
That's so funny. I suffer from suspension of disbelief almost at all times with films and literature. So it takes me a while to get to the questioning. But yeah, it's an interesting point. Is this a fantasy? I hadn't really thought about it much, because you saying heterosexual couplings resonates, because, I mean, oh gosh, I guess in my, just from years in Los Angeles with, you know, very close friends who were gay males, couplings like this happen all the time. You know, I used to skulk around the library that was not unlike our basement, except much bigger, because I knew that this was a place where men would go to find sex, and there was this part of me that was really curious. I was like, okay, I know that this is one of, like, the top 10 places in Los Angeles where, you know, and you just imagine, like, boys leaping on each other behind bookcases in moments of exquisite passion. And I don't know. I wasn't trying... Oh, I guess I'm a bit voyeuristic, and I wasn't actually trying to see a coupling. I was just curious about what that moment would be like. It feels... There's a showiness, I guess, about the way the author writes his inner thoughts. And, yeah, maybe that folds into... How much can we really trust him?
Hmm. And this cartoon quality. I mean, that was a word that jumped out for me. It's like a movie, maybe an animated cartoon, because that's quite helpful, I found, because it sort of frames the sex. Because without her saying, think about it as an animated cartoon, I think I would perhaps read it in a more self-conscious way. I'd be reading it with my Literary Review Bad Sex Award hat on, you know, sort of, oh, okay, is she going to get away with being able to, you know, is she going to get away with writing well about sex and not a kind of a cheesy way? But by saying, well, it is sort of cartoonish, it almost allows me to read it without that self-consciousness. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think so. I mean, the italics also kind of put you at one remove, because it implies something that isn't the present of the text in a way, you know?
Mm. What do you think is going through her mind, whether she's a fantasy or not? What is going through her mind when she says, hey, hey, she calls out after him, he's vanishing out of the path, hey. Just the way you read it, I was trying to work out, it felt like you as the character had an idea, you had something was going on for you internally.
I think I read it as a kind of, you know, hey, this can't be all that there is. Surely that, you know, the kind of intensity of the encounter that is described, surely that can't be it. You know, surely chemistry just doesn't flare like that and then disappear and what you run off. You know, I think there's, you know, I think for her it probably felt like an incomplete flirtation. It was consummated, but surely there should be something more when there's this kind of intensity between two people that just comes suddenly while jogging one morning through the forest. But also it says something about perhaps how sex is perceived differently between men and women, that perhaps the sort of cathartic, just the encounter that is meant to give release, and that's it, that's fine for men, but is more problematic for women, which I guess on a biological and level makes sense, you know? Because after all, the women, if anything, you know, if they become pregnant, that's a lot more to carry around, you know, I guess, tiny puns intended.
His days are made up of what he calls real time and the interstices, which is another... As soon as I read that line, I suppose, I sort of thought, God, I wonder what my... Which aspects of my existence and my day would I class as sort of real? And real gets a bit of a bad showing here, and the interstices, which is obviously the, you know, the sort of the exciting stuff, the creative stuff. I mean, what was your thinking around that pairing?
I mean, you know, you think about it a bit in work sometimes. You know, you imagine what it's like to be an editor or a publicist or a writer, and I think there's a kernel that really excites you, and then, unfortunately, always have to find out that booking someone on a show or hosting an event is amazing, but then there's all that legwork that you have to do that I guess one classifies more easily as real time, because it is more, it's more associated to kind of just the day-to-day, the things one does to get this amazing thing to happen that, you know, is exciting for you and amps your, you know, and gets all your brain chemicals fired up, and I don't know, I think it's kind of a sad but maybe accurate way to divide up time. Because if I also, in terms of creativity, there's the, you know, there's the beautiful burst of inspiration, and then there's the getting it down in paint or ink or, you know, into your computer and whittling it into a perfect object that then becomes that pure perfect, well, not pure, but the sort of solid, tangible expression of the beautiful firework that happened. But I don't think this character would have any fun if he didn't have real time. I mean, I imagine that Akiko, his wife, is firmly in real time. And her presence makes possible the incredible experiences he's having on the side. Incredible, dark, lusty, you know, disturbing love affairs with clients, and then he brings sort of droplets of the interstices back home and scatters them around the house to kind of unwittingly, wittingly unnerve Akiko. And they you know, both are needed.
Well, let's find out a little bit. I mean, it's great that you brought up Akiko, because that's actually how the novel starts, with her.
Oh yeah, look at that. Shall we? A small private park that Akiko has transformed into a scene from the tale of Genji extends beyond the house. It has a broad path that leads to the public trails, thickets, a wetland, a lake. I run from our house into the public land in the mornings, often alone in the early light. I can run for over an hour without hearing the hum of city traffic. This early in the day, there is something more than royal about this domain. It is mythical. I run toward the past. Not my own past, mind you, but a distant, primal past. Past in which my own infancy, or the current lousy state of affairs, or even the great city beyond the bluff, is unimaginable. Today, when I return to the house, I see the lights are on in Akiko's studio. This means I will find a thermos of fresh green tea waiting for me on the kitchen counter. A sweet gesture, considering how evasive I am with her. Akiko has come to confuse my evasiveness with a retiring nature. In her words, I am the silent type. My silence conceals a wealth of worlds best left undisclosed. We have been together 10 years, long enough for my idiosyncrasies to have faded into invisibility. Akiko, too, has faded, She is the white noise I've come to depend upon, and possibly cannot live without. Akiko is witchy, clairvoyant. Her astonishing dreams are astute, surgical. They keep me on my toes. This marriage of ours puts us both at risk. She is in danger because I lie incessantly, and the habit of these lies has blunted her gift and confused her. Love has caused her to distrust her own intuitions. Yet I am in danger also, because I cannot help but offer her clues. It is inevitable that sooner or later I will falter, offer one clue too many, and in this way, bring us both down. When I fall, she will fall with me. Perhaps this is a comfort of a kind. My practice belongs to a shelf in the devil's kitchen, insulated above suspicion. I take my pleasure and am sustained by the sorrow of others, their carnality, the ceaseless ebb and tide of human inconstancy, negligence, cowardice. In the world I know, everyone is betrayed sooner or later. The practice is not of my own making. I mean, it is an inheritance of a kind. I have wandered its maze since infancy. I do not know another way to live. I often wish I did. The practice is the inevitable extension of my own private dilemma. It is lethal, and yet without it I would perish. Assiduously, I portion out its poisons. Assiduously, I orchestrate the days. Like a game of chess, the practice proposes an infinite set of circumstances. Or, rather, not exactly infinite, for I begin to, and this admission is terrifying, to see how redundant, how compressed the games are. My clients are thwarted, famished, and lonely. Inevitably, sooner or later, I seize upon and penetrate the one who has wanted this from me from the first instant, or has taken the time but has come around to wanting it. For a client, fucking the doctor is always perceived as a triumph, although I am always curious from the start. In this way, I am made. If the client is attractive, I cannot help but wonder, is she, he, fuckable? An outrageous determination, and yet, fucking is the one determinism, the one inevitability. In this way, it is exactly like death. You know you'll be fucked, and you know you'll die, and maybe be murdered, and maybe murder. I've known transcendent sex, but its promise frightens me. The risks of delight are immense. The infant feeding at the madwoman's breast, slipping deliciously in and out of slumber, is fiercely smacked. Smacked when he sups, he is quickly weaned. In no time, he has learned to suck up, bite, and wean, always watchful for the hook. He travels deep into the world of men with his deft set of sharpened tools. He will become a hoodlum, a maniac, a soldier. He will become a priest, a prison guard, a cop, a dogmatist, a patriarch, decidedly in public danger. He will become a psychoanalyst. He will have a practice. He will learn to dissemble. He will laugh like a wolf. He will cut through the city streets like a blade through water. His realm will be the streets, their secret stores of pleasure, their secret drawers. I have a drawer full of keys, opening to wondrous rooms, unfamiliar rooms, shabby rooms. He is attracted to, appalled by, shabby rooms. The street boy's spare depot, the shop girl's cluttered cheese box, the saturated confusion of the drag queen's aviary, her floor slick with hairspray and powder. He must take care to shed these scents, to kick the dust up behind him before returning home. Unlike a female client, a man in a wig, a boy smelling of malnutrition, are not likely to hire a lawyer. In recent years, I've pretty much neglected Akiko. These days we live in something of a parallel universe. Sometimes I catch a glimpse of her strolling the garden in her dreamy way. Sometimes she vanishes for a week or more. My wife displays her work in distant cities where it is apparently much appreciated, as it should be. There are times when I admire her imagination, the autonomy it assures her, and I so needful of company. Day after day she paces her studio with her scissors, the glue pot, those images she has culled from all times and places. She's like a creature from a fairy tale, my Akiko. Beautiful, ethereal, living much of her life alone, with her scissors, and in silence, piecing scraps of paper together. Always she returns from her journeys with stories and presents for me. Rare Netsuke, for example, although I have so little interest in aesthetic devices.
Thanks. So we have here, it seems like the sort of the real time, which is Akiko, as you suggested, sort of these bookending all of this stuff, mainly to do with sex, that makes up the practice, which is very, very much part of his interstices. What is this practice? I mean, it's, he gives it with a capital P.
Well, I mean, his practice is transgression. I mean, if you think about practice in terms of yoga practice or practicing meditation,
yes.
the idea that he will inevitably have sex with his clients and that they want that. I mean, it seems that he's probably the most unethical, dangerous kind of psychoanalyst, you know, someone who preys on vulnerable people, but also figures himself as a kind of savior, that this is a special kind of analysis that they're entering into, and that he can somehow save them through, you know, his magical sex. And I don't know, I just find this so fascinating. He is a figure that one should be able to trust to be alone in a room with and share, you know, and go into deep self-exploration. The fact that he transgresses so boldly and with such glee and kind of evangelism of his own power, you know.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, you know, and the way he takes that home. Kind of, I mean, it's an interesting setup, the practice being that sacred space, the interstices, I presume, and then the real time of Akiko, if we're going to follow that train of thought, that the way they interplay, you know, that he drops those clues like seeds, and one day he will give one clue too many, and the whole thing will come falling down. I think, you know, most of us at some point will have experienced the sort of weight of a betrayal and of a lie, and, you know, to varying extents, of course, but how the world does come crumbling down in some way, that you fundamentally question something about that you had previously believed. I mean, I guess it's part of the passage of from childhood to adulthood, and in some way realizing that everybody isn't out there looking out for you, that you have to have a kind of armor or a filtration system, I guess, is something closer to what I mean.
And what's your feeling, or what are your feelings about her as she's presented to us here?
I mean, it's funny because he has, as he says, so little interest in aesthetic devices, yet he's with a woman whose entire world is beautifully crafted, you know, from the dinners that they have. I mean, the food just sounds incredible. I want a wife who will make such a beautiful garden and then welcome me with tea and a thermos and fragrant dishes and company and friends. And he's picked a woman who is aesthetically pleasing and creates an aesthetically pleasing world. And I don't get the impression that he really sees her, you know, that she is presented as this, like a creature, kind of a sprightly creature who does incredible things with beauty, something also intangible, you know? And then he, you know, mentions that she's a little bit clairvoyant and witchy.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you pick up on her witchy clairvoyance, because she's still in some way kind of tuned into him, I suppose, maybe, whereas he's really completely tuned, he's tuned her out, hasn't he?
That's interesting, yeah. That seems about right. She does what he does, she does what she does, and I think he allows himself to believe that she just does those things, and she's still in the contract of their relationship. We're told that she loves, like, her beautiful Tale of Genji garden, you know, her koi fish. But yeah, we don't get to know just yet that much about her.
Mm.
She's like the title of the book, one of those beautifully crafted Natsuke objects.
Well, shall we read a little bit more about the practice then?
Sure. The practice is contained within two home cabinets situated at the entrance to our property. But my clients do not know there is a house beyond, nestled in the woods. Akiko's studio, as well, is invisible. Perched upon the edge of a small ravine, both appear to soar above the canopy. From within our rooms, Akiko notices and points out to me the deer, the snowy owls, the seasonal hummingbirds. The home cabinets are well rooted to the ground by a stone path and garden, all of Akiko's design. My wife is addicted to perfection and adheres to a dogmatic system both ancient and alien to me, and beneficial. In terms of my need to dissemble, she is my greatest gift. The cabinets are impeccably set out. They are spare, and they are superb. Each has its own waiting room. The cabinets both open to a hallway that leads to my own private library and office. One of the cabinets I call Spells. I cannot enter it without my heart beating faster. The other I call Drear. If Spells is devoted to the pleasures of transgression, Drear belongs to all the rest. Lutherans, a defrocked priest, a wafer-thin old maid, a psychopath who has bungled more surgeries than he has toes, the retired night watchman who squanders his pension on whores and whose wife of 40 years is suing for divorce. There is also the CEO of a local company undoubtedly responsible for my city's dramatic number of birth defects, a college professor, the most tedious of the bunch, who drones on and on about a lost inheritance and his wife's dismal affair with the family dentist. It was once a young scholar I took a fatherly interest in, and who managed to elicit a real tenderness. Do not think me incapable of tenderness. Sometimes a client will move up from Drear to Spells, even after many years. There was an actress once, as rageful as a bloody axe, who over time was soothed and then began, it seemed miraculous, to flourish. One day I saw how beautiful she had become, how vigorous, how eager for the world and its delights, how desirous, also, of transgression. I invented an excuse, claimed Drear needed to be reconfigured, and moved her to Spells. There I allowed her to seduce me. I always, she told me on her knees, wanted this. The affair triggered a shift in her expectations and charisma. She landed a major role downtown. That was 10 years ago. And if her roles are now less glamorous, she still invites me to opening nights. Spells is the theater where my clients and I break all the rules. And this, under the banner of mindful subversion, convulsive beauty. What happens here is stunning, somehow always unique, if orchestrated. I never forget that I am dealing with people who, despite their determinisms, their needful tenderness, their pride, can at any moment decide to kill me or call their lawyers. And so Spells is oiled with solicitude and sweetness and the infinite capacity that seems to be mine to convey that each transgression is unprecedented. To assure this impression, I have at times, and after a period of months or weeks, revealed a previous violation many, many years before when I was green and still vulnerable. Such a revelation convinces the most skeptical of my good intentions, my passionate interest in them, and the anomaly of our love affair represents. The lady in question, now a mistress, will assure me that my secret is safe with her, as safe as she believes she is with me. The affair remains circumscribed within the process of recovery. I do not accept gifts, apart from little love gifts, so like those of high school girls, I simply cannot refuse. I explain that because our lovemaking is an extension of our work together, the fee will be the same. In this way, I become my client's whore. Yet I always manage to act professionally, My infatuations are in the service of knowledge. My clients love this. We fuck in the stellar radiance of knowledge and love. I am enamored of my profession. The women are intelligent, sexy, neurotic, funny, inventive, feisty, sprightly, and they are in need of me. They do yoga, tai chi. They are in fine fettle and in great shape. They play tennis, they go to the sporting club, they get massages and go to Botox parties. They are sleek as seals. The men? This is more complicated.
Thank you. What's it like reading him? Voicing him?
What struck me the most was, I mean, as in the chapters that we've read, occasionally there are parentheses where he announces something to the reader. I have a drawer full of keys. And here, with his dreary college professor, he remembers, in parentheses, there was once a young scholar. And then a second set of parentheses, do not think me incapable of tenderness. I mean, it strikes me as a man who's a character who's unable really to feel or to express himself, but knows that there are feelings. And I don't believe that we're meant to think that he's incapable of tenderness, but it's just the bid to recognize that tenderness is a quality that is a given. You know, it's written, I mean, it's written in very easily, as in with human interaction. It's, you know, the way you hold your body, or if you reach out to touch somebody on the hand and as a gesture of comfort. I mean, you know, tenderness is not something you usually need to point out. So, you know, you get the sense of you get the sense of crumbling and delusion. Delusion, exactly, your word. Yeah. This a delusional main character who is incredibly attractive because of the, you know, the fantastic prose. You're taken into the reality of someone who lives in a slightly other reality, you know, and that there's Akiko, his wife, who is grounding. She has feelings that you can sense, through his descriptions of her. There's a, like, an omission of description that allows you to kind of feel a wealth of emotion that must be pooling inside this woman who is being lied to and being neglected and isn't stupid. You know, the way she approaches life, just, I don't know, it's fascinating to be able to view the world through, I guess, omission. And that's what the character gives us a lot of. We get his kind of, the way he uses and manipulates the people around him, and the sort of childlike thrust or push or joy that he has when he can just kind of, I guess, a primal satisfaction in, let's just pretend it was real, like betting the woman in the forest or betting each and every one of his clients. But you just get a real sense that there is a seething, feeling, beautiful, troubled world that lives between the lines, between the text.
So the freedom of transgression, in a way, the freeing.
In terms of fiction, I think she achieves so much by, I feel like the author doesn't really intervene and tell you what you're supposed to think about the character, and it's just there's so much open space to dive into the text and to really read into it what you like. You know, it has, I mean, that's what poetry often has, the sort of the brevity of the form and the precision of the language. It's taught, but it gives you so much space to kind of, you know, feel and imagine, think and savor, you know.
It feels like a real exploration of a cast of mind, of a particular, as you say, a particular way of seeing the world, which is not the whole person, but it's that aspect of him, but done you know, given to you very boldly and given to you without the bullshit, I suppose, essentially.
Mm. Or only with his bullshit.
Or only with his bullshit, yeah.
And it's kind of attractive. I mean, imagine feeling so confident in yourself. I don't know. There's this kind of... There's a kind of insouciance. It's I guess, the pleasure of liking the bad guy in a film. You know, that there's part of you that kind of... That there's part of me that finds it really appealing. And... But also the mechanism of betrayal. It seemed like such an accurate representation of how those things go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there are those little clues. They do make you feel crazy or doubt your intuition. I still think that he thinks that Akiko is described as witchy and clairvoyant is interesting because he's... It's not clairvoyance, it's just sucking in information. You know, he's dropping the clues, so she's observant?
Mm-hmm.
Not clairvoyant,
mm-hmm.
You know?
And he's almost conscious... I mean, he says later, doesn't he? At some point he says he's sort of consciously... He's consciously dropping the clues. There's part of him that's sort of wanting to be caught out.
And sometimes he can't help it, like a sneeze, that he just does. Yeah. And I think that, bringing it back to sort of the real and the interstices, it's a compulsion that is not to the service
compulsive.
Of good,
It feels that he's losing a sense of himself, perhaps. He's losing, perhaps, that tenderness which he thinks he's... which he knows he's capable of.
Affairs and betrayal, it's such a common... The Peter Stamm novel, 7 Years, that I just finished reading. I mean, there's another book about betrayal, and I think we're just kind of fundamentally interested in how we break the contracts we make with people we love and why sometimes it seems inevitable that will happen.
Mm.
And they're kind of the great mini or major tragedies that kind of thread through lives and are really poisonous. And I don't know, I think that's what she's... For me, this is the novel that does that the best.
Yeah.